Interview with the Onion AV Club by Keith Phipps. Quote, I think the idea of art kills creativity, end quote. DNA. The Onion. You've got a lot of stuff going on. What do you want to talk about first? Douglas Adams. I guess there are two main things. One is that we are imminently about to finish this thing that I've been labouring over for what seems like 2 years now, called Starship Titanic, which is a CD-ROM. It's coming out in a couple months' time. The other thing is that I've just agreed to the sale of Hitchhiker's Guide to Disney. So I guess over the next couple of years, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm making that movie. Onion. Tell me about Starship Titanic. Douglas. Well, it's a CD-ROM, and the most important thing is that it started as a CD-ROM. People wanted me to do a CD-ROM of Hitchhikers, and I thought, no. I didn't want to just sort of reverse-engineer yet another thing from a book I'd already written. I think that the digital media are interesting enough in their own right to be worth originating something in. Because really, the moment you have any idea, the second thought that enters your mind after the original idea is, what is this? Is it a book? Is it a movie? Is it a this? Is it a that? Is it a short story? Is it a breakfast cereal? Really, from that moment, your decision about what kind of thing it is then determines how it develops. So something will be very, very different if it's developed as a CD-ROM than if it's developed as a book. Now, in fact, I tell a slight lie, because the idea as such, in a sort of single-paragraph form, actually was what it was in one of the Hitchhiker books. I think Life, the Universe and Everything. Because whenever I'd get sort of stuck on a storyline in Hitchhiker, I'd always invent a couple of other quick storylines and give them to the guide to talk about. So here was one little idea that was sitting there, and a number of people said to me, "Oh, you should turn that into a novel." It just seemed like too much of a good idea, and I tend to resist those. But in fact, I discovered there was a very good reason why I wasn't interested in doing Starship Titanic as a book, which was that essentially it was a story about a thing. I just thought of this idea, and didn't have any people attached to it, and you can only really tell stories about people. So later, when I was thinking, okay, now I want to do a CD-ROM, because I want to justify the fact that I spend all my time sitting fiddling around with computers, I actually wanted to turn it into proper grown-up work. So I was thinking, what would be a good thing? Then I suddenly remembered that the problem with turning Starship Titanic into a book, that it was about a thing, about a place, about a ship, suddenly became very much to its advantage. When you're doing a CD-ROM, what you're eventually going to create is a place, an environment. The Onion. And the user becomes the character. Douglas. Yes, exactly. Once the place begins to develop, you then put the characters in it. But it isn't about the characters, it's about the ship. What I then wanted to do was something, well, it was either very old-fashioned or very radical, depending on which way you look at it. I wanted to build a conversation engine into the game. Years and years ago, I did a game based on Hitchhiker's Guide with a company called Infocom, which was a great company. They were doing witty, intelligent, literate games based on text. You know, there are several thousand years of human culture telling you you can do quite a lot with text, and putting in the extra element of interactivity should just add to the possibilities. You turn the computer into the storyteller, and the player into the audience, like in the old days when the storyteller would actually respond to the audience, rather than just have the audience respond to the storyteller. I had an enormous amount of fun, actually, working on that. I just loved constructing these virtual conversations between the player and the machine. So I just thought it'd be lovely to try to extend that and do more with it in a modern graphics game. Because what I would like to do is see if one can take that old conversation technology and make characters really speak. Put them in an environment and see where you go from there. So we started to tackle this problem of being able to speak to the characters. Of course, everything you do with language just balloons as a problem. To begin with, we wanted to do it whereby it would be text-to-speech, which gives you the advantage that you have much more flexibility in constructing sentences on the fly. On the other hand, all of your characters sound like semi-concussed Norwegians, which I felt is a downside. So we eventually realized we were going to have to do pre-recorded speech. And I thought, that's terrible, because you only have a limited number of responses. It's just going to be... Oh, I'm not sure about that. So, the way we eventually solved the problem, or gradually solved the problem, was that the amount of pre-recorded speech just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. We just did another 2-hour recording session this morning. We've now got something like 16 hours of little conversational snippets, little phrases, sentences, half-sentences, and all the things the machine puts together on the fly in response to what you type in. For a long time, it wasn't working very well. It was stupid, and it didn't understand what the fuck it was saying. And now, just really in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it started to come together, and it started to be spooky. People come in and say, yeah, I don't see how this is going to work. How about if you ask it this? And they do, and their jaw drops. It's just wonderful. People come in and spend hours just sitting, locked in conversation with these characters. I hasten to add that with the 16 hours of dialogue, it was a small team of us who wrote it. I did part of the dialogue writing, and other people did some, and we all pulled it together. It's pretty remarkable when it works. You suddenly have this populated world. Very strange, damaged robots crawling around the place, all of whom have a wide range of opinions and attitudes and ideas and strange histories, and know about some entirely unexpected things. You can engage them all in conversation. The Onion. Do you feel concerned that after all this work, people won't treat it with the gravity of, say, a movie or a book? That they won't treat it as an art form? Douglas. I hope that's the case, yes. I get very worried about this idea of art. I've been trying to... Having been an English literary graduate, I've been trying to avoid the idea of doing art ever since. I think the idea of art kills creativity. That was one of the reasons I really wanted to go and do a CD-ROM, because nobody will take it seriously, and therefore you can sneak under the fence with lots of good stuff. It's funny how often it happens. I guess when the novel started, most early novels were just sort of pornography. Apparently most media actually started as pornography and sort of grew from there. This is not a pornographic CD-ROM, I hasten to add. Before 1962, everybody thought pop music was sort of... Nobody would have ever remotely called it art. And then somebody comes along and is just so incredibly creative in it, just because they love it to bits and think it's the greatest fun you can possibly have. And within a few years you've got Sgt. Pepper's and so on, and everybody's calling it art. I think media are at their most interesting before anybody's thought of calling them art, when people still think they're just a load of junk. The Onion. But say, 20 years from now, would you like to be recognised as one of the earliest practitioners of CD-ROM as art? Douglas. Well, I would just like a lot of people to have bought it. One, for the extremely obvious reason, but the other is that if it's popular and people really like it and have fun with it, you feel you've done a good job. And if somebody wants to come along and say, oh, it's art, well, that's as it may be. I really don't mind that much, but I think that's for other people to decide after the fact. It isn't what you should be aiming to do. There's nothing worse than sitting down to write a novel and saying, well, okay, I'm going to do something of high artistic worth. It's funny. I read something the other day, just out of absolute curiosity. I read Thunderball, which is one of the James Bond books that I would love to have read when I was, oh, I don't know, about 14, just sort of thumbing through it for the bits where he puts his left hand on her breast and saying, oh my God, how exciting. But I just thought, well, James Bond has become such an icon in our pop culture in the last 40 years, it would be interesting to see what it actually was like. And what prompted me to do this, apart from the fact that I happened to find a copy lying around, was reading someone talking about Ian Fleming and saying that he had aimed not to be literary, but to be literate, which is a very, very big and crucial difference. So I thought, well, I'll see if he managed to do that. It's interesting, because it was actually very well written as a piece of craft. He knew how to use the language, he knew how to make it work, and he wrote well. But obviously nobody would call it literature. But I think you get most of the most interesting work done in fields where people don't think they're doing art, but are merely practicing a craft and working as good craftsmen. Being literate as a writer is good craft, is knowing your job, is knowing how to use your tools properly and not to damage the tools as you use them. I find when I read literary novels, you know, with a capital L, I think an awful lot is nonsense. If I want to know something interesting about a way human beings work, how they relate to each other and how they behave, I'll find an awful lot of women crime novelists who do it better. Ruth Rendell, for instance. If I want to read something that's really giving me something serious and fundamental to think about the human condition, if you like, or what we're all doing here or what's going on, then I'd rather read something by a scientist in the life sciences, like Richard Dawkins, for instance. I feel that the agenda of life's important issues has moved from novelists to science writers, because they know more. I tend to get very suspicious of anything that thinks it's art while it's being created. As far as being a CD-ROM is concerned, I just wanted to do the best thing I could and have as much fun as I could doing it. I think it's pretty good. There are always bits that you fret over for being less than perfect, but you can't keep on worrying over something forever. The thing is pretty damn good. The Onion. You've got the movie too. I'd heard rumours of a Hitchhiker's Guide movie kicking around for decades. Douglas. Oh, well, yeah. Although it sort of bubbles under, there have been two previous sources of rumours. One was when I originally sold the rights about 15 years ago to Ivan Reitman, who was not as well known then as he is now. It really didn't work out, because once we got down to it, Ivan and I didn't really see eye to eye. In fact, it turned out he hadn't actually read the book before he bought it. He'd merely read the sales figures. I think it really wasn't his cup of tea, so he wanted to make something rather different. Eventually, we agreed to differ and went our respective ways, and by this time, the ownership had passed from him to Columbia, and he went on to make a movie called Ghostbusters, so you can imagine how irritated I was by that. It sat there, owned by Columbia, for many years. I think Ivan Reitman then got somebody else to write a script based on it, which is, I think, the worst script I'd ever read. Unfortunately, it has my name on it, and the other writers, whereas I did not contribute a single comma to it. I've only just discovered that that script has been sitting in Script City, or wherever it is, for a long time, and that everyone assumes I wrote it, and am therefore a terrible screenwriter, which is rather distressing to me. So then, a few years ago, I was introduced to someone who became a great friend of mine called Michael Nesmith, who has done a number of different things in his career. In addition to being a film producer, he was originally one of the Monkees, which is kind of odd when you get to know him, because he's such a serious, thoughtful, quiet chap, but with quiet reserves of impish glee. So his proposal was that we go into partnership together to make this. He's the producer, and I do the scripts and so on. We had a very good time working on it for quite a while, but I just think Hollywood at that point saw the thing as old. It's been around the block. And basically, what I was being told an awful lot was essentially, science fiction comedy will not work as a movie, and here's why not. If it could work, somebody would have done it already. The Onion. That logic seems kind of flawed. Douglas. So what happens, of course, is that Men in Black came out this past year, so suddenly somebody has done it already. And Men in Black is... How can I put this delicately? There were elements of it I found quite familiar, shall we say. And suddenly a comedy science fiction movie that was very much in the same vein as Hitchhikers became one of the most successful movies ever made. So that kind of changed the landscape a little bit. Suddenly people kind of wanted it. The project with Michael... In the end, we hadn't gotten it to take, so we parted company, very good friends, and still are. I just hope that there will be other projects in the future that he and I will work on together, because I like him enormously, and we got on very well together. And also, the more time I get to spend in Santa Fe, the better. So now the picture's with Disney, or more specifically with Caravan, which is one of the major independent production companies, but it's kind of joined at the hip to Disney. It's been very frustrating not to have made it in the last 15 years. Nevertheless, I feel extremely buoyed by the fact that one can make a much, much, much better movie out of it now than one could have 15 years ago. That's in technical terms, in terms of how it will look and how it will work. Obviously, the real quality of the picture is in the writing and the acting and the directing and so on and so forth, and those skills have neither risen nor sunk in 15 years, but at least one substantial area in how it can be made to look has improved a great deal. The Onion. And Jay Roach, who directed Austin Powers, is directing it, right? Douglas. That's right. He's a very interesting fellow. I've now spent quite a lot of time talking to him. The key to the whole thing, in many ways, was when I met Jay Roach, because I hit it off very well with him and thought, here's a very bright, intelligent guy. Not only is he a bright, intelligent guy, but here's a measure of how bright and intelligent he is. He wants me to work very closely on his movie. Which is always something that endears a writer to a director. In fact, when I was making the original radio series, it was unheard of to do what I did. Because I'd just written it. But I kind of inserted myself in the whole production process. The producer-director was a little surprised by this, but in the end took it in very good grace. So I had a huge amount to do with the way the program developed, and that's exactly what Jay wants me to do on this movie. So I felt, great, here's somebody I can do business with. Obviously I'm saying that at the beginning of a process that's going to take 2 years, so who knows what's going to happen. All I can say is that at this point in the game, things are set as fair as they possibly could be, so I feel very optimistic and excited about that. The Onion. It's been nearly 20 years since the radio program, right? Douglas. Well, it's almost 20 years. It'll be 20 years next month. The Onion. What's the enduring appeal of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Douglas. Well, I don't know. All I know is that I worked very hard at it, and I worried very much about it, and I think I made things very difficult for myself doing it. And if ever there was an easy way of doing something, I would find a much harder way to do it. And I suspect that the amount that people have found in it is not unrelated to the amount of work I put into it. That's a simplistic thing to say, but that's the best I can come up with. The Onion. Is the idea that the movie will cover the first book? Douglas. Yeah, it's funny, because I've been looking around the web at what people have been saying. I've seen, he's going to put all 5 books into it. People just don't understand the way a book maps onto a movie. Somebody said, and I think quite accurately, that the best source material for a movie is a short story, which effectively means, yes, it's going to be the first book. Having said that, whenever I sit down and do another version of Hitchhikers, it highly contradicts whichever version went before. The best thing I can say about the movie is that it will be specifically contradicting the first book. The Onion. Which version of Hitchhiker are you happiest with? Douglas. Not the TV version, that's for sure. In different moods, I will feel either the radio or the book, which are the two other versions left, so it's got to be one of those, hasn't it? I feel differently about each of them. On the one hand, the radio series was where it originated. That's where it grew. That's where the seed grew. Also, that's where I felt that myself and the other people working on it, the producer and the sound engineers and so on, and of course the actors, all created something that really felt groundbreaking at the time. Or rather, it felt like we were completely mad at the time. I can remember sitting in the subterranean studio auditioning the sound of a whale hitting the ground at 300 miles an hour for hours on end, just trying to find ways of tweaking the sound. After hours of that, day after day, you do begin to doubt your sanity. Of course, you have no idea if anybody's going to listen to this stuff. But you know, there was a real sense that nobody had done this before, and that was great. There's a great charge that comes with that. On the other hand, the appeal of the books to me is that it's just me. The real appeal of a book to any writer is that it is just them. That's it. There's nobody else involved. That's not quite true, of course, because the thing developed out of a radio series in the first place, and there is a sense in there of all the people who have contributed in one way or another to the radio show that it grew out of. But nevertheless, there is a this-is-all-my-own-work feel about the book, and I'm pleased with the way it reads. I feel it flows nicely. It feels as if it were easy to write, and I know how difficult that was to achieve. The Onion. Do you ever get tired of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Douglas. There was a period when I got heartily sick of it, and I really never wanted to hear anything more about it again, and I would almost scream at anybody who used the words to me. But since then, I went off and did other things. I did the Dirk Gently books. My favourite thing that I've ever done was a thing I did about 10 years ago. I went around the world with a zoologist friend of mine and looked for various rare and endangered species of animals and wrote a book about that called Last Chance to See, which is my own personal favourite. Hitchhiker now is something from the past that I feel very fond of. It was great, it was terrific, and it's been very good to me. I had a conversation a little while ago with Pete Townsend of The Who, and I think at that point I was saying, oh God, I hope I'm not just remembered as the person who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he kind of reprimanded me a little bit. He said, look, I have the same thing with Tommy, and for a while I thought like that. The thing is, when you've got something like that in your history, it opens an awful lot of doors. It allows you to do a lot of other things. People remember that. It's something one should be grateful for. And I thought that was quite right. The Onion. Have you put Dirk Gently aside? Douglas. Well, I started to write another Dirk Gently book, and I just lost it. For some reason, I couldn't get it going, so I had to put it aside. I didn't know what to do with it. I looked at the material again about a year later and suddenly thought, actually, the reason is that the ideas and the character don't match. I've tried to go for the wrong kind of ideas, and these ideas would actually fit much better in a Hitchhiker book. But I don't want to write another Hitchhiker book at the moment, so I sort of put them on one side. And maybe one day I will write another Hitchhiker book, because there's an awful lot of material sitting round waiting to go in it. Another reason is that the last one, Mostly Harmless, is a very bleak book. People have tried to read all sorts of complicated reasons into it, and the reason was that I just had a lousy year. Just for all sorts of personal reasons, from a terrible death in the family to every kind of area, whether it was personal or professional, had just gone sour on me against a background in which I had to write a funny book, which turned out not to be very funny. So I'd quite like to maybe do another Hitchhiker book that sort of perks up the tone again. But going back to Dirk Gently, I sort of put Dirk aside, really. There was a student production of Dirk Gently in Oxford 2 or 3 months ago, so I went along to see it. And it's an enormously complicated plot. Part of the complexity is there to disguise the fact that the plot doesn't really work. It was funny watching it on stage because I suddenly began to think about it again and think, well, they did this well, but what they should have done was this, and they should have done that. You know, it starts the whole ball rolling in your head. What was also interesting to me was that while I was sitting there being quite critical of the production, I was astonished by how much the audience was enjoying it. It was rather sort of a peculiar situation. I suddenly thought, I would love to see this happen as a film, because I can now see, having thought about it freshly in this context, what kind of a movie it could be, and it could be great. So maybe, once the Hitchhiker movie has gotten to the stage where I can turn my attention to other things as well, that's what I'd like to do next. And hopefully, with that movie underway, I hope more doors will open as far as filmmaking is concerned. I would love to do movies, but this is a man saying this innocently, who's never done one. 1998. From Douglas Adams, 22 Duncan Terrace, London, N1, HBS. April 14th, 1999. To David Vogel, Walt Disney Pictures. Dear David, I've tried to reach you by phone a couple of times. Perhaps it would have helped if I'd explained why I was calling. I was in the States for a few days and thought it might be helpful if I came across to L.A. so that you and I could have a meeting. I didn't hear from you, so I'm on a plane back to England, where I'm typing this. We seem to have gotten to a place where the problems appear to loom larger than the opportunities. I don't know if I'm right in thinking this, but I only have silence to go on, which is always a poor source of information. It seems to me that we can either slip into the traditional stereotypes, you're the studio executive who has a million real-world problems to worry about, and I'm the writer who only cares about seeing his vision realized and hang the cost and consequences, or we can recognize that we both share the same goal, which is to make the most successful movie we possibly can. The fact that we may have different perspectives on how this can best be achieved should be a fertile source of debate and iterative problem-solving. It's not clear to me that a one-way traffic of written notes interspersed with long, dreadful silences is a good substitute for this. You have a great deal of experience nursing major motion pictures into existence. I have a great deal of experience of nursing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy into existence in every other medium other than motion pictures. I'm sure you must feel frustrated that I don't seem to understand the range of problems you have to contend with, just as I feel frustrated that I haven't had any real creative dialogue with Disney about this project yet. I have a suggestion to make. Why don't we actually meet and have a chat? I could be in L.A. for next Monday, 4/19, or early the following week. I would invite Disney to bear the cost of this extra trip over. I've appended a list of numbers you can reach me on. If you manage not to reach me, I shall know you're trying not to. If you manage not to reach me, I shall know you're trying not to. Very, very hard indeed. Best wishes, Douglas Adams. The Private Life of Genghis Khan. Based on an original sketch by Douglas Adams and Graham Chapman. The last of the horsemen disappeared into the smoke, and the thudding of their hooves receded into the grey distance. The smoke hung on the land. It drifted across the setting sun, which lay like an open wound across the western sky. In the ringing silence that followed the battle, very, very few, pitifully few cries could be heard from the bloody, mangled wreckage on the fields. Ghost-like figures, stunned with horror, emerged from the woods, stumbled and then ran forward, crying. Women searching for their husbands, brothers, fathers, lovers, first amongst the dying and then amongst the dead. The flickering light by which they searched was that of their burning village, which had, that afternoon, officially become part of the Mongol Empire. The Mongols. From out of the wastes of Central Asia they had swept, a savage force for which the world was utterly unprepared. They swept like a wildly wielded scythe, hacking, slashing, obliterating all that lay in their path, and calling it conquest. And throughout the lands that feared them now, or would come to fear them, no name inspired more terror than that of their leader, Genghis Khan. The greatest of the Asian warlords, he stood alone, revered as a god among warriors, marked out by the cold light of his grey-green eyes, the savage furrow of his brow, and the fact that he could beat the shit out of any of them. Later that night, the moon rose, and by its light a small party of horsemen carrying torches rode quietly out from the Mongol encampment that sprawled over a nearby hill. A casual observer would not have noticed anything remarkable about the man who rode at their center, muffled in a heavy cloak, tense, hunched forward on his horse as if weighed down by a heavy burden. Because a casual observer would have been dead. The band rode a few miles through the moonlit woods, picking their way along the paths until they came at last to a small clearing, and here they reined their horses in and waited on their leader. He moved his horse slowly forward and surveyed the small group of peasant huts that stood huddled together in the center of the clearing, trying very hard at short notice to look deserted. Hardly any smoke at all was rising from the primitive chimney stacks. Virtually no light appeared at the windows, and not a sound could be heard from any of them save that of a small child saying, "Shh." For a moment a strange green fire seemed to flash from the eyes of the Mongol leader. A heavy, deadly kind of a thing that you could hardly call a smile drew itself through his fine, wispy beard. The strange kind of smiley thing would signify, briefly, to anyone who was stupid enough to look, that there was nothing a Mongol warlord liked better after a day hacking people to bits than a big night out. The door flew open, A Mongol warrior surged into the hut like a savage wind. Two children ran screaming to their mother, who was cowering wide-eyed in the corner of the tiny room. A dog yelped. The warrior hurled his torch onto the still glowing fire, and then threw the dog onto it. That would teach it to be a dog. The last surviving man of the family, a grey and aged grandfather, stepped bravely forward, eyes flashing. With a flash of his sword, the Mongol whipped off the old man's head, which trundled across the floor and fetched up, leaning rakishly against a table leg. The old man's body stood tensely for a moment, not knowing what to think, as it began slowly, majestically, to topple forward. Khan strode in and pushed it brusquely aside. He surveyed the happy domestic scene and bestowed a grim kind of smile on it. Then he walked over to a large chair and sat in it, testing it first for comfort. When he was satisfied with it, he heaved a heavy sigh and sat back in front of the fire on which the dog was now blazing merrily. The warrior grabbed at the terrified woman, pushed her children roughly aside, and brought her trembling in front of the mighty Khan. She was young and pretty, with long, bedraggled black hair. Her bosom heaved, and her face was stark with fright. Khan regarded her with a slow, contemptuous look. "Does she know," he said at length in a low, dead voice, "who I am?"
You are the mighty Khan," cried the woman.
Khan's eyes fixed themselves on hers. "Does she know," he hissed, "what I want of her?"
I'll do anything for you, O Khan," stammered the woman, "but spare my children."
Khan said quietly, "Then begin." His eyes dropped and he gazed distantly into the fire. Nervously, shaking with fear, the woman stepped forward and laid a tentative pale hand on Khan's arm. The soldier smacked her hand away. "Not that," he barked. The woman started back, a flutter. She realized she would have to do better. Still shaking, she knelt down on the floor and started gently to push apart the Khan's knees. "Stop that," roared the soldier, and shoved her violently backwards. Bewilderment began to mix with the terror in her eyes as she cowered on the floor. "Come on," snapped the soldier. "Ask him what kind of day he's had."
"What?" she wailed. I don't understand what—"
The soldier seized her, span her into a half-Nelson, and jabbed the point of his sword against her throat.
"I said, ask him," he hissed, "what kind of day he's had."
The woman gasped with pain and incomprehension. The sword jabbed again.
"Say it!"
What sort of day?
She said in a hesitant, strangled squeak.
"Have you had?"
"Dear," hissed the soldier. "Say dear."
Her eyes bulged in horror at the sword.
"What sort of day have you had, dear?" she asked querulously.
Khan looked up, briefly, wearily.
"Oh, same as usual," he said. "Violent."
He gazed back at the fire again.
"Right," said the soldier to the woman. "Go on."
She relaxed very slightly. She seemed to have passed some kind of test. Perhaps it would be straightforward from now on, and she could at least get it over with. She moved nervously forward and started to caress the Khan again. The soldier hurled her savagely across the room, kicked her and yanked her screaming to her feet again.
"I said stop that," he bellowed.
He pulled her face close to his and breathed a lungful of cheap wine and weak old rancid goat fat fumes at her, which failed to cheer her up because it reminded her sharply of her late lamented husband, who used to do the same thing to her every night. She sobbed.
"Be nice to him,"
the Mongol snarled, and spat one of his unwanted teeth at her.
"Ask him how his work's going."
She gawped at him. The nightmare was continuing. A stinging blow landed on her cheek.
"Just say to him," the soldier snarled again, "how's the work going, dear?"
He shoved her forward.
How's the work going, dear?"
she yelped miserably. The soldier shook her.
"Put some affection into it," he roared.
She sobbed again.
How's the work going, dear?"
she yelped miserably again, but this time with a kind of pathetic pout at the end. The mighty Khan sighed.
"Oh, not too bad, I suppose," he said in a world-weary tone. "We swept through Manchuria a bit and spilt quite a lot of blood there. That was in the morning. Then this afternoon was mainly pillaging, though there was a bit of bloodshed around 4:30. What sort of day have you had?"
So saying, he pulled a couple of scroll maps from out of his furs and started to study them abstractedly by the light of the smouldering dog.
The Mongol warrior pulled a glowing poker out of the fire and advanced menacingly on the woman.
"Tell him. Go on."
She leapt back with a shriek.
"Tell him."
My husband and father were killed," she said.
"Yes, dear," said Khan absently, not looking up from his maps.
"Dog was burnt."
Oh, really?
Well, that's about it, really.
The soldier advanced on her with the poker again.
"Oh, and I was tortured a bit," shrieked the woman.
Khan looked up at her. "What?" he said vaguely. "Sorry, dear. I was just reading this."
"Right," said the soldier. "Nag him."
"What?"
"Just say, 'Look, Genghis, put that thing away while I'm talking to you. Here I am, spend all day slaving over a hot—"
"He'll kill me."
"Bleeding kill you if you don't."
"I can't stand it,"
cried the woman and collapsed on the floor. She flung herself on the great Khan's feet.
"Don't torment me," she wailed. "If you mean to rape me, then rape me, but don't—"
The great Khan surged to his feet and glowered down at her.
"No,"
he muttered savagely. "You'd only laugh. You're just like all the others." He stormed out of the hut and rode off into the night in such a rage that he almost forgot to burn down the village before he left. After another particularly vicious day, the last of the horsemen disappeared into the smoke and the thudding of their hooves receded into the grey distance. The smoke hung on the land. It drifted across the setting sun, which lay like an open wound across the western sky. In the ringing silence that followed the battle, very, very few, pitifully few cries could be heard from the bloody, mangled wreckage on the fields. Ghost-like figures, stunned with horror, emerged from the woods, stumbled and then ran forward, crying. Women searching for their husbands, brothers, fathers, lovers, first amongst the dying and then amongst the dead. Far away, behind the screen of smoke, thousands of horsemen arrived at their sprawling camp, and with a huge amount of clatter, shouting, and comparing of backhand slashes, they dismounted and instantly started in on the cheap wine and rancid goat fat. In front of his splendidly bedraped imperial tent, a blood-stained and battle-weary Khan dismounted. "Which battle was that?" he asked his son Ogdai, who had ridden with him. Ogdai was a young and ambitious general, keenly interested in viciousness of all kinds. He was hoping to improve on his own known world record for the highest number of peasants impaled on a single sword thrust, and would be getting in some practice that night. He strode up to his father. "It was the Battle of Samarkand, O Khan," he proclaimed, and rattled his sword in a tremendously impressive way. Khan folded his arms and leant on his horse, looking over it across the dreadful mess they'd made of the valley beneath them. "Oh, I can't tell the difference any more," he said with a sigh. "Did we win?"
"Oh, yes, yes, yes," exclaimed Ogdai with fierce pride. "It was a mighty victory indeed. Indeed it was," he added, and waggled his sword again. He drew it excitedly and made a few practice thrusts. Yes, he thought to himself, tonight he was going to go for the six.
Khan screwed his face up at the gathering dust. "Oh, dear," he said. "After 20 years of these two-hour battles, I get the feeling that there must be more to life, you know." He turned, lifted up the front of his torn and blooded gold-embroidered tunic, and stared down at his own hairy tummy. "Here, feel this," he said. "Do you think I'm putting it on a bit?" Ogdai gazed at the great Khan's tummy with a mixture of awe and impatience.
No, he said. "No, not at all."
With a flick of his fingers, Ogdai summoned a servant to bring the maps to him, ran him through, and as he fell, caught from his nerveless but not entirely surprised fingers the plans of the grand campaign. "Now, O Khan," he said, spreading the map over the back of another servant who stood specially hunched over for the purpose, "we must push forward to Persia, and then we shall be poised to take over the whole world." "No, look, feel that," said Khan, pinching a fold of skin between his fingers. "Do you think—"
"Khan," interrupted Ogdai urgently, "we are on the point of conquering the world."
He stabbed at the map with a knife, catching the servant beneath a nasty nick on his left lung. "When?" said Khan with a frown. Ogdai threw up his arms in exasperation.
"Tomorrow," he said. "We start tomorrow."
"Oh, well, tomorrow's a bit difficult, you see," said Khan. He puffed out his cheeks and thought for a moment. "The thing is that next week I've got this lecture on carnage techniques in Bokhara, and I thought I'd use tomorrow to prepare it." Ogdai stared at him in astonishment as the map-bearing servant slowly collapsed on his foot.
"Well, can't you put that off?" he exclaimed. "Well, you see, they've paid me quite a lot of money for it already, so I'm a bit committed."
"Well, Wednesday."
Khan pulled a scroll from out of his tunic and looked through it, shaking his head slowly. "Not sure about Wednesday."
"Thursday?"
"No, Thursday I am certain about. We've got Ogdai and his wife coming round to dinner, and I'd kind of promised—"
"But I am Ogdai."
"Well, there you are, then. You wouldn't be able to make it either." Ogdai's silence was only disturbed by the sound of thousands of hairy Mongols shouting and fighting and getting pissed.
"Look," he said quietly, "will you be ready to conquer the world on Friday?"
Khan sighed. "Well, the secretary comes in on Friday mornings."
"Does she?"
"All those letters to answer. You'd be astonished at the demands people try to make on my time, you know." He slouched moodily against his horse. "Would I sign this? Would I appear there? Would I please do a sponsored massacre for charity? So that usually takes till at least 3, then I had hoped to get away early for a long weekend. Now, Monday, he consulted his scroll again. "Monday's out, I'm afraid. Rest and recuperation, that's one thing I do insist upon. Now, how about Tuesday?" The strange keening noise that could be heard in the distance at this moment sounded like the normal everyday wailing of women and children over their slaughtered menfolk, and Khan paid it no mind. A light bobbed on the horizon. "Tuesday. Look, I'm free in the morning. No, hold on a moment. I'd sort of made a date for meeting this awfully interesting chap who knows absolutely everything about understanding things, which is something I'm awfully bad at. Now that's a pity, because that was my only free day next week. Now, next Tuesday we could usefully think about, or is that the day I..." The keening sound continued. In fact, it grew, but it was so lightly borne upon the evening breeze that it still did not intrude itself on Khan's senses. The approaching light was so pale as to be indistinguishable from that of the moon, which was bright that night. "So that's more or less the whole of March out," said Khan, "I'm afraid."
"April?"
asked Ogdai, wearily. He idly whipped out a passing peasant's liver, but the joy had gone out of it. He flipped the thing listlessly off into the dark. A dog, which had grown very fat over the years by the simple expedient of staying close to Ogdai at all times, leapt on it. These were not pleasant times. "Well, no. April's out," said Khan. "I'm going to Africa in April. That's one thing I had promised myself." The light approaching them through the night sky had now at last attracted the attention of one or two other leading Mongols in the vicinity, who, wonderingly, stopped hitting each other and stabbing things, and drew near.
"Look,"
said Ogdai, himself still unaware of what things were coming to pass,
"can we please agree that we will conquer the world in May, then?"
The mighty Khan sucked doubtfully on his teeth. "Well, I don't like to commit myself that far in advance. One feels so tied down if one's life is completely mapped out beforehand. I should be doing more reading, for heaven's sake. When am I going to find the time for that? Anyway," he sighed and scratched at his scroll, "May, possible conquest of the world. Now, I've only penciled that in, so don't regard it as absolutely definite, but keep on at me about it and we'll see how it goes."
End of side 4B.